It was because you picnicked in the place, Call said, confused by her anger. He would have thought a woman would feel complimented by such a request, but Clara clearly didn't take it that way. Yes, I remember our picnics, she said. We mostly quarreled. He wanted what I wouldn't give, and I wanted what he didn't have. That was a long time ago, before my boys died. Tears came to her eyes when she said it, as they always did when the thought of her boys struck her. She was aware that she was being anything but hospitable, and that the man didn't understand what she said. She scarcely knew what she meant herself. She just knew that the sight of Woodrow Call aroused in her an unreasoning hate and disgust. He wrote you, Call said, remembering why he had come. There's a letter for you and one for her. He left her his half of our cattle. He untied his saddlebag and brought out the two notes, handing them to Clara. I would have sent them with Dish, but he left in the winter. There was no knowing if he'd get through. But you always get through, don't you, Captain? Clara said, with a look so hard that Call turned aside from it and stood by the horses, tired. He was ready to agree with her that Gus had been foolish to make such a request of him. Then he turned and saw Clara walk over to Greasy, the mule. She stroked the mule along his neck and spoke to him softly before breaking into sobs. She hid her face against the mule, who stood as if planted. Though normally he was a rather skittish animal, but he stood while Clara sobbed against his side. Then, taking the notes and not looking at Call, she hurried into the house. From the lots, Dish and July were watching. Dish felt a little queasy, seeing Gus's coffin. He had not gotten over his nervousness about the dead. It seemed to him quick burial was the best way to slow their ghosts. July, of course, had heard all about Gus McCrae's death and his strange request, but had not quite believed it. Now it had turned out to be true. He remembered that Gus had ridden down with him on the Kiowa campfire and killed every single man, while he himself had not been able to pull a trigger. Now the same man, dead a whole winter, had turned up in Nebraska. It was something out of the ordinary. Of that he felt sure. I knowed the captain would do it, Dish said. I bet them boys up on the milk are good and scared now he's gone. I hear it's hard winters up there, July said. Not that they were easy in Nebraska. The captain, as if distracted, walked a little way toward the lots and then stopped. Dish walked out to greet him, followed by July, and was shocked by the change in the man. The captain looked like an old man. He had little flesh on his face, and his beard and mustache were sprinkled with gray. "Why, Captain, it's fine to see you," Dish said. "How are them northern boys doing?" Call shook Dish's hand, then July's. "We wintered without losing a man, or much stock either," he said, very tired. Then he saw that Dish was looking beyond him. He turned and saw that the blonde woman had come out of the house. She walked to the buggy and stood by the coffin. Clara's two daughters followed her out on the back porch, a toddling child between them. The girls didn't follow Lorena to the buggy. They watched a minute and then guided the child back in the house. Dish Bogart would have given anything to be able to go to Lorena, but he knew he couldn't. Instead, he led the captain back down to the lots and tried to interest him in the horses. But the captain's mind was elsewhere. When the plains darkened and they went to supper, Lorena still stood by the wagon. The meal was eaten in silence, except for little Martin's fretting. He was used to being the center of gay attention and couldn't understand why no one laughed when he flung his spoon down, or why no one sang to him or offered him sweets. "Oughtn't we to go get Lori?" Dish asked at one point, anguished that she was left to stand alone in the darkness. Clara didn't answer. The girls had cooked the meal, and she directed the serving with only a glance now and then. Watching Woodrow Call awkwardly handling his fork caused her to repent a little of her harshness when he arrived. But she didn't apologize. She had stopped expecting July to contribute to the conversation, but she resented his silence nevertheless. Once Martin spat out a bite of perfectly good food, and Clara looked at him sharply and said, "You behave. in a tone that instantly put a stop to his fretting. Martin opened his mouth to cry, but thought better of it and chewed miserably on a spoon until the meal was finished. After supper, the men went out of the house to smoke, all glad to escape the company of the silent woman. Even Betsy and Sally, accustomed to chattering through supper, competing for the men's attention, were subdued by their mother's silence, and merely attended to serving. After supper, Clara went to her bedroom. Gus's letter lay on her bureau, unread. She lit her lamp and picked it up, scratching at the dried blood that stained one corner of the folded sheet. "I ought not to read this," she said aloud. "I don't like the notion of words from the dead." "What, Mama?" Betsy asked. She had come upstairs with Martin and had overheard. "Nothing, Betsy. Just a crazy woman talking to herself. Martin acts like he's got a stomachache. You didn't have to look so mean at him, Ma." Clara turned for a moment. "I won't have him spitting out food. The reason men are awful is because some woman has spoiled them. Martin is going to learn manners if he learns nothing else." "I don't think men are awful," Betsy said. "Dish ain't. Let me be, Betsy. Put Martin to bed." She opened the letter. Just a few words in a scrawling hand. "Dear Clara, I would be obliged if you'd look after Laurie. I fear she'll take this hard. I am down to one leg now, and this life is fading fast, so I can't say more. Good luck to you and your gals. I hope you'll do well with the horses. Gus." Clara went out on her porch and sat, twisting her hands for an hour. She could see that the men were below, still smoking, but they were silent. "It's too much death," she thought. "Why does it keep coming to me?" The dark heavens gave no answer, and after a while she got up and went downstairs and out to Lorena, who still stood by the buggy where she had been from the time call arrived. "Do you want me to read you this letter?" she said, knowing the girl couldn't read. "It's bad handwriting." Lorena held the letter tightly in her hand. "No, I'll just keep it," she said. "He put my name on it. I can read that. I'll just keep it." She didn't want Clara to see the letter. It was hers, from Gus. What the words were didn't matter. Clara stood with her for a bit and went back in. The moon rose late, and when it did, the men walked to the little shack by the lots where they slept. The old Mexican was coughing. Later, Lorena heard the captain get his bedroll and walk away with it. She was glad when the lights went out in the house and the men were all gone. It made it easier to believe Gus knew she was there. "They'll all forget you. They've got their doings," she thought. "But I won't, Gus. Whenever it comes, morning or night, I'll think of you. You come and got me away from him. She can forget, and they can forget. But I won't. Never, Gus." The next morning, Lorena still stood by the buggy. The men scarcely knew what to think about it. Call was perplexed. Clara made breakfast as silently as she had presided over supper. They could all look out the window and see the blonde girl standing like a statue by the buggy, the letter from Augustus clutched in her hand. "For that girl's sake, I wish you'd forget your promise, Mr. Call," Clara said finally. "I can't forget no promise to a friend," Call said. "Though I do agree it's foolish, and I told him so myself." "People lose their mind over things like this," Clara said. "Gus was all to that girl. Who'll help me if she loses hers?" Dish wanted to say that he would, but couldn't get the words out. The sight of Laurie standing in grief made him so unhappy that he'd wished he'd never set foot in the town of Lonesome Dove. Yet he loved her, though he could not approach her. Clara saw it was hopeless to hammer at Call. He would go unless she shot him. His face was set, and only the fact that the girl stood by the buggy had kept him from leaving already. It angered her that Gus had been so perverse as to extract such a promise. There was no proportion in it, being drugged 3,000 miles to be buried at a picnic site. Probably he had been delirious and would have withdrawn the request at once if he had been allowed a lucid moment. What angered her most was Gus's selfishness in regard to Carl's son. He had been a sweet boy with lonesome eyes, polite. He was the kind of boy she would have given anything to raise. And here, for a romantic whim, Gus had seen to it that father and son were separated. It seemed so wrong to her, and raised such anger in her, that for a moment she was almost tempted to shoot Carl, just to thwart Gus. Not kill, but shoot him enough to keep him down until Gus could be buried and the folly checked. Then, between 1 minute and the next, Lorena crumpled to the ground, unconscious. Clara knew it was only a faint, but the men had to carry her in and upstairs. Clara shooed them out as soon as she could, and put Betsy to watching her. By that time, Captain Call had hitched the brown mule to the buggy and mounted his horse. He was ready to go. Clara walked out to try once more. Dish and July were shaking hands with Call, but they beat an immediate retreat when they saw her coming. "I put it to you once more, in the plainest terms, Mr. Call," Clara said. "A live son is more important than a dead friend. Can you understand that?" "A promise is a promise," Carl said. "A promise is words. A son is a life," Clara said. "A life, Mr. Carl. I was better fit to raise boys than you've ever been, and yet I lost three. I'll tell you, no promise is worth leaving that boy up there as you have. Does he know he's your son?"
"I suppose he does."
"I'll give him my horse," Carl said, feeling that it was hell to have her, of all women, talk to him about the matter.
"Your horse, but not your name," Clara said. "You haven't even given him your name.
I put more value on the horse," Carl said, turning the dun. He rode off, but Clara, terrible in her anger, strode beside him.
"I'll ride him," she said. "I'll see he gets your name if I have to carry the letter to Montana myself. And I'll tell you another thing. I'm sorry you and Gus McCrae ever met. All you two done was ruin one another, not to mention those close to you. Another reason I didn't marry him was because I didn't want to fight you for him every day of my life. You men and your promises, they're just excuses to do what you plan to do anyway, which is leave. You think you've always done right, and that's your ugly pride, Mr. Call. But you never did right, and it would be a sad woman that needed anything from you. You're a vain coward for all your fighting. I despised you then for what you were, and I despise you now for what you're doing." Clara could not check her bitterness, even now. She knew the man thought he was doing the right thing. She strode beside the horse, pouring out her contempt, until Carl put the mule and the dun into a trot, the buggy with the coffin on it, squeaking as it bounced over the rough plain.
Chapter 102.
So Captain Carl turned back down the rivers, cut by the quirt of Clara's contempt and seared with the burn of his own regret. For a week, down from the Platte and across the Republican, he could not forget what she said, that he had never done right, that he and Gus had ruined one another, that he was a coward, that she would take a letter to the boy. He had gone through life feeling that he had known what should be done, and now a woman flung it at him that he hadn't. He found that he could not easily forget a word Clara said. He could only trail a buggy down the lonely plains, her words stinging in his heart and head. Before he reached Kansas, word had filtered ahead of him that a man was carrying a body home to Texas. The plain was filled with herds, for it was full summer. Cowboys spread the word. Soldiers spread it. Several times he met trappers coming east from the Rockies, or buffalo hunters who were finding no buffalo. The Indians heard, Pawnee and Arapaho and Ogallala Sioux. Sometimes he would ride past parties of braves, their horses fat on spring grass, come to watch his journey. Some were curious enough to approach him, even to question him.
Why did he not bury the companero? Was he a holy man whose spirit must have a special place? No, Carl answered. Not a holy man. Beyond that, he couldn't explain. He had come to feel that Augustus had probably been out of his mind at the end, though he hadn't looked it, and that he had been out of his mind to make the promise he had. In 1 week in Kansas, he ran into 8 cattle herds. He would no sooner pass one than he encountered another. The only advantage to him was that the trail bosses were generous with wire and pliers. The Miles City buggy had been patched so many times that it was mostly wire by then, Carl felt. He knew it would never make Texas, but he determined to keep going as long as he could. What he would do when it finally fell apart, he didn't know. Finally, he was asked about Augustus and the purpose of his journey so many times that he couldn't tolerate it. He turned west into Colorado, meaning to skirt the main cattle trails. He was tired of meeting people. His only moments of peace came late in the day when he was too tired to think and was just bouncing along with Gus. He rode through Denver, remembering that he had never sent Wilbarger's brother the telegram he had promised, notifying him of Wilbarger's death. It had been a year, and he felt he owed Wilbarger that consideration, though he soon regretted coming into the town. A noisy place filled with miners and cattlemen. The sight of the buggy with a coffin excited such general curiosity that by the time he was out of the telegraph office, a crowd had gathered. Carl had scarcely walked out the door when an undertaker in a black hat and a blue bow tie approached him. "Mister, you ain't nowhere near the graveyard," the man said. He had even waxed his mustache and was altogether too shiny for Carl's taste. "I wasn't looking for it," Carl said, mounting. People were touching the coffin as if they had the right. "We give a nice $10 funeral," the undertaker said. "You could just leave the fellow with me and come pick out the gravestone at your leisure. Of course, the gravestone's extra." "Not in the market," Carl said. "Who is it, mister?" a boy asked. "His name was McCrae," Carl said. He was glad to put the town behind him, and thereafter took to driving at night to avoid people, though it was harder on the buggy, for he couldn't always see the bumps. One night he felt the country was too rough for evening travel, so he camped by the Purgatory River, or picket wire, as the cowboys called it. He heard the sound of an approaching horse and wearily picked up his rifle. It was only one horse. Dusk had not quite settled into night, and he could see the rider coming, a big man. The horse turned out to be a red mule, and the big man Charles Goodnight. Carl had known the famous cattleman since the 50s, and they had ridden together a few times in the frontier regiment before he and Gus were sent to the border. Carl had never taken to the man. Goodnight was indifferent to authority, or at least unlikely to put any above his own. But he could not deny that the man had uncommon ability. Goodnight rode up to the campfire but did not dismount. "I like to keep up with who's traveling the country," he said. "I admit I did not expect it to be you." "You're welcome to coffee," Carl said. "I don't take much else at night," he added. "Hell, if I didn't take some grub in at night, I'd starve," Goodnight said. "Usually too busy to eat breakfast." "You're welcome to get down, then," Carl said. "No, I'm too busy to do that either," Goodnight said. "I've got interest in Pueblo. Besides, I was never a man to sit around and gossip. I reckon that's McCrae," he said, glancing at the coffin on the buggy. "That's him," Carl said, dreading the questions that seemed to be inevitable. "I owe him a debt for cleaning out that mangy bunch on the Canadian," Goodnight said. "I'd have soon had to do it myself if he hadn't." "Well, he's past collecting debts," Carl said. "Anyway, he let that darn killer get away." "No shame to McCrae," Goodnight said. "I let the son of a bitch get away myself, and more than once, but a luckier man caught him. He butchered 2 families in the Bosque Redondo. And as he was leaving, a deputy sheriff made a lucky shot and crippled his horse. They ran him down and mean to hang him in Santa Rosa next week. If you spur up, you can see it.
Well, I swear, Carl said. Are you going?
No, Goodnight said. I don't attend hangings, although I've presided over some of the homegrown sort. This is the longest conversation I've had in 10 years. Goodbye.
Carl took the buggy over Raton Pass and edged down into the great New Mexican plain. Though he had seen nothing but plains for a year, he was still struck by the immense reach of land that lay before him. To the north, there was still snow on the peaks of the Sangre de Cristo. He hurried to Santa Rosa, risking further damage to the wagon, only to discover that the hanging had been put back a week. Everyone in the territory wanted to see Blue Duck hanged, it seemed. The little town was full of cowhands, with women and children sleeping in wagons. There was much argument, most of it in favor of hanging Blue Duck instantly, lest he escape. Parties were constantly forming to present petitions to the sheriff, or else storm the jail, but the latter were unenthusiastic. Blue Duck had ranged the Llano for so long, and butchered and raped and stolen so often, that superstitions had formed around him. Some, particularly women, felt he couldn't die, and that their lives would never be safe. Carl took the opportunity to have a blacksmith completely rebuild the buggy. The blacksmith had lots of wagons to work on and took 3 days to get around to the buggy, but he let Carl store the coffin in his back room, since it was attracting attention. The only thing to do in town besides drink was to admire the new courthouse, 3 stories high with a gallows at the top, from which Blue Duck would be hung. The courthouse had fine glass windows and polished floors. 2 days before the hanging was to take place, Carl decided to go see the prisoner. He had already met the deputy who crippled Blue Duck's horse. The man, whose name was Decker, was fat and stone drunk, leading Carl to suspect that Goodnight had been right. The shot had been lucky. But every man in the territory had insisted on buying the deputy a drink since then. Perhaps he had been capable of sobriety before he became a hero. He was easily moved to sobs at the memory of his exploit, which he had recounted so many times that he was hoarse. The sheriff, a balding man named Owensby, had of course heard of Carl and was eager to show him the prisoner. The jail had only 3 cells, and Blue Duck was in the middle one, which had no window. The others had been cleared, minor culprits having simply been turned loose in order to lessen the chances that Blue Duck might somehow contrive an escape. The minute Carl saw the man, he knew it was unlikely. Blue Duck had been shot in the shoulder and leg, and had a greasy rag wound around his forehead, covering another wound. Carl had never seen a man so draped in chains. He was handcuffed. Each leg was heavily chained, and the chains draped around his torso were bolted to the wall. 2 deputies with Winchesters kept constant watch. Despite the chains and bars, Carl judged that both were scared to death. Blue Duck himself seemed indifferent to the furor outside. He was leaning back against the wall, his eyes half closed when Carl came in. "What's he doing?" Sheriff Owensby asked. Despite all the precautions, he was so nervous that he had not been able to keep food down since the prisoner was brought in.
"Ain't doing much," one deputy said.
"What can he do?"
"Well, it's been said that he can escape from any jail," the sheriff reminded them. "We've got to watch him close."
"The only way to watch him closer is to go in with him, and I'll quit before I do that," the other deputy said.
Blue Duck opened his slumberous eyes a fraction wider and looked at Carl.
"I hear you brought your stinking old friend to my hanging," Blue Duck said, his low, heavy voice startling the deputies and the sheriff, too.
"Just luck," Carl said.
"I should have caught him and cooked him when I had the chance," Blue Duck said.
"They would have killed you," Carl said, annoyed by the man's insolent tone.
"Or I would have, if need be."
Blue Duck smiled.
"I raped women and stole children and burned houses and shot men and run off horses and killed cattle and robbed who I pleased all over your territory." ever since you've been a law. And you never even had a good look at me until today. I don't reckon you would have killed me.
Sheriff Owensby reddened, embarrassed that the man would insult a famous ranger. But there was little he could do about it. Call knew there was truth in what Blue Duck said, and merely stood looking at the man, who was larger than he had supposed. His head was huge in his eyes, cold as snake's eyes.
"I despise all you fine-haired sons of bitches," Blue Duck said. "You rangers. I expect I'll kill a passel of you yet."
"I doubt it," Carl said. "Not unless you can fly."
Blue Duck smiled a cold smile.
"I can fly," he said. "An old woman taught me. And if you care to wait, you'll see me."
"I'll wait," Carl said.
On the day of the hanging, the square in front of the courthouse was packed with spectators. Carl had to tie his animals over 100 yards away. He wanted to get started as soon as the hanging was over. He worked his way to the front of the crowd and watched as Blue Duck was removed from the jail to the courthouse in a small wagon under heavy escort. Carl thought it likely someone would be killed accidentally before it was over, since all the deputies were so scared that they had their rifles on cock. Blue Duck was as heavily chained as ever and still had the greasy rag tied around his head wound. He was led into the courthouse and up the stairs. The hangman was making last-minute improvements on the hang rope, and Call was looking off, thinking he saw a man who had once served under him in the crowd, when he heard a scream and a sudden shattering of glass. He looked up, and the hair on his neck rose, for Blue Duck was flying through the air in his chains. It seemed to Call the man's cold smile was fixed on him as he fell. He had managed to dive through one of the long glass windows on the third floor, and not alone, either. He had grabbed Deputy Decker with his handcuffed hands and pulled him out, too. Both fell to the stony ground right in front of the courthouse. Blue Duck hit right on his head, while the deputy had fallen backwards, like a man pushed out of a hayloft. Blue Duck didn't move after he hit, but the deputy squirmed and cried. Tinkling glass fell about the two men. The crowd was too stunned to move. Sheriff Owensby stood high above them, looking out the window, mortified that he had allowed hundreds of people to be cheated of a hanging. Call walked out alone and knelt by the two men. Finally, a few others joined him. Blue Duck was stone dead, his eyes wide open, a cruel smile still on his lips. Decker was broken to bits and spitting blood already. He wouldn't last long.
"I guess that old woman didn't teach you well enough," Call said to the outlaw.
Owensby ran down the stairs and insisted that they carry Blue Duck up and string him from the gallows.
"By God, I said he'd hang and he'll hang," he said.
Many of the spectators were so afraid of the outlaw that they wouldn't touch him, even dead. 6 men who were too drunk to be spooked finally carried him up and left him dangling above the crowd. Call thought it a silly waste of work, though he supposed the sheriff had politics to think of. He himself could not forget that Blue Duck had smiled at him in the moment that he flew. As he walked through the crowd, he heard a woman say she had seen Blue Duck's eyes move as he lay on the ground. Even with a man hanging from a gallows, the people were priming themselves to believe that he hadn't died. Probably half the crimes committed on the Llano in the next 10 years would be laid to Blue Duck. As Call was getting into his wagon, a newspaper man ran up. A red-headed boy, scarcely 20 years old, white with excitement at what he had just seen.
"Captain Call?" he asked. "I write for the Denver paper. They pointed you out to me. Can I speak to you for a minute?"
Call mounted the dun and caught the mule's lead rope.
"I have to ride," he said. "It's still a ways to Texas."
He started to go, but the boy would not give up. He strode beside the dun, talking, much as Clara had, except that the boy was merely excited. Call thought it strange that 2 people on 1 trip would follow him off.
"But, Captain," the boy said, "they say you're the most famous ranger. They say you've carried Captain McCrae 3,000 miles just to bury him. They say you started the first ranch in Montana. My boss will fire me if I don't talk to you. They say you're a man of vision.
Yes. A hell of a vision, Carl said.
He was forced to put spurs to the dun to get away from the boy, who stood scribbling on a pad. It was a dry year, the grass on the Llano brown, the long plain shimmering with mirages. Carl followed the Pecos down through Bosque Redondo and south through New Mexico. He knew it was dangerous. In such a year, Indians might follow the river, too, but he feared the drought worse. At night, lightning flickered high above the plains. Thunder rumbled, but no rain fell. The days were dull and hot, and he saw no one, just an occasional antelope. His animals were tiring, and so was he. He tried driving at night, but had to give it up. Too often, he would nod off, and once came within an ace of smashing a buggy wheel. The coffin was sprung from so much bouncing and began to leak a fine trail of salt. A day above Horsehead Crossing, as he was plodding along half asleep in the still afternoon, he felt something hit him and immediately put his hand to his side. It came away bloody. Although he had not seen an Indian or even heard a gunshot, as he turned to race for the river, he glimpsed a short brown man rising from behind a large yucca plant. Carl didn't know how badly he was shot or how many Indians he was up against. He went off the bank too fast, and the buggy crashed against a big rock at the water's edge. It splintered and turned over, the coffin underneath it. Carl glanced back and saw only four Indians. He dismounted and snuck north along the river for 100 yards and was able to shoot one of the four. He crossed the river and waited all day and all night, but never saw the other three again. His wound felt minor, though the bullet was somewhere in him, and would have to stay until he made Austin, he knew. The narrow-channeled Pecos was running, and the coffin was underwater. Carl finally cut it loose, and with the help of Greasy, dragged it from the mud. He knew he was in a fine fix, for it was still 500 miles to the South Guadalupe, and the buggy was ruined. For all he knew, more Indians might arrive at any moment, which meant he had to work looking over his shoulder. He managed to drag the coffin over, but it was a sorry, muddy affair by the time he was done. Also, the Pecos water scalded his innards and drained his strength. Carl knew he could never drag the coffin all the way to Austin. He himself would be lucky to get across the bleached, waterless land to the Colorado or the San Saba. On the other hand, he had no intention of leaving Gus, now that he had brought him so far. He broke open the coffin and rewrapped his friend's remains in the tarp he had been using for a bed cover on wet nights. There were few of those to worry about. Then he lashed the bundle to Gus's sign, itself well weathered, with most of the lettering worn off. He cut down a small salt cedar and made a crude axle, fixing the sign between the two buggy wheels. It was more travois than buggy, but it moved. He felt his wound a trifle less every day, though he knew it had been a small-bore bullet that hit him. A larger bore, and he would be down and probably dead. Several times he thought he glimpsed Indians slipping over a ridge or behind distant yucca, but could never be sure. Soon he felt feverish and began to distrust his own eyesight. In the shining mirages ahead, he thought he saw horsemen, who never appeared. Once he thought he saw Dietz, and another time Blue Duck. He decided his reason must be going, and began to blame Gus for it all. Gus had spent a lifetime trying to get him into situations that confused him, and had finally succeeded.
"You done this,"
he said aloud several times.
"Jake started me off, but you was the one that sent me back across here."
His water ran out the third day. The mule and the dun chewed on the greasewood bushes, or what sage there was, but both were weakening. Carl longed for the Kiowa mare. He wished he had given the boy his name and kept the mare. Then Greasy, the mule, stopped. He had decided to die. Carl had to use the dun to pull the travois. Greasy didn't bother following them. Carl supposed the dun would die too, but the horse walked on to the Colorado.
After that, there was little more to fear, although his wound festered somewhat and leaked. It reminded him of Lippy. Often his eyes would fill when he thought of the boys left up north. By the time he finally rode onto the little hill with the live oaks above the Guadalupe, the sign was about gone. The Latin motto, of which Augustus had been so proud, being at the bottom, had long since been broken off. The part about the pigs was gone. And the part about what they rented and sold, and Dietz's name as well. Most of P.I.'s name had flaked off, and his own also. Call hoped to save the plank where Gus had written his own name, but the rope he had tied the body with had rubbed out most of the lettering. In fact, the sign was not much more than a collection of splinters, two of which Call got in his hands as he was untying Gus. Only the top of the sign, the part that said Hat Creek Cattle Company and Livery Emporium, was still readable. Call dug the grave with a little hand shovel. In his condition, it took most of the day. At one point, he grew so weak that he sat down in the grave to rest, sweat pouring off of him. If there had been anyone else to shovel, he would have been inclined to be buried there himself. But he pulled himself up and finished the work and lowered Augustus in. "There," he said. "This will teach me to be more careful about what I promise." He used the plank with Hat Creek Cattle Company and Livery Emporium on it as a crossbar, tying it to a long mesquite stick, which he drove into the ground with a big rock. While he was tying the crossbar tight with two saddle strings, a wagon with settlers in it came along the ridge. They were a young couple, with two or three children peeking shyly around them, narrow-faced as young possums. The young man was fair, and the sun had blistered him beet red. His young wife had a bonnet pulled close about her face. It was clear that the grave marker puzzled them. The young man stopped the wagon and stared at it, not having seen him put Augustus under. They were not sure whether they were looking at a grave or just a sign. "Where is this Hat Creek outfit, mister?" the young man asked. "Buried. What ain't in Montana," Call said. He knew it wasn't helpful, but he was in no mood for conversation. "Darn! I was hoping to come to a place with a blacksmith," the young man said. Then he noticed that Call walked stiffly and saw that he was wounded. "Can we help you, mister?" the young man asked. "Much obliged," Call said. "I've only a short way to go." The young settlers moved down the ridge toward San Antonio. Call walked down to the little pool, meaning to rest a few minutes. He fell into a heavy sleep and didn't wake until dawn. The business of the sign worried him. One more evidence of Augustus's ability to vex well beyond the grave. If one young man supposed it meant there was a livery stable nearby, others would do the same. People might be inconvenienced for days, wandering through the limestone hills, trying to find a company who were mostly ghosts. Besides, Augustus's name wasn't on the sign, though it was his grave. No one might ever realize that it was his grave. Call walked back up the hill and got out his knife, thinking he might carve the name on the other side of the board, but the old board was so dry and splintery that he felt it might destroy it altogether if he worked on it much. Finally, he scratched A.M. on the other side of the board. It wasn't much, and it wouldn't last, he knew. Somebody would just get irritated at not finding the livery stable and bust the sign up anyway. In any case, Gus was where he had decided he wanted to be. And they had both known many fine men who lay in unmarked graves. Call remembered he had told the young couple that he only had a short way to travel. It showed that his mind was probably going, for he had no place in particular to travel at all. Worn out and with a festering wound, he was in no shape to turn back for Montana, and Jerry, the Dunn, could never have made the trip, even if he himself could have. He didn't know that he wanted to go back, for that matter. He had never felt that he had any home on the earth anyway. He remembered riding into Texas in a wagon when just a boy. His parents were already dead. Since then, it had been mostly roaming, the years in Lonesome Dove apart. Call turned south toward San Antonio, thinking he might find a doctor. But when he came to the town, he turned and went around it, spooked at the thought of all the people. He didn't want to go among such a lot of people with his mind so shaky. He rode the weary dun on south, feeling that he might just as well go to Lonesome Dove as anywhere. Crossing the green Nueces, he remembered the snakes and the Irish boy. He knew he ought to go and find the Widow Spettle and tell her she had one less son, but decided the bad news could wait. It had already waited a year, unless she had gotten it from one of the returning cowhands. He rode the dun into Lonesome Dove late on a day in August, only to be startled by the harsh clanging of the dinner bell, the one Bolivar had loved to beat with a broken crowbar. The sound made him feel that he rode through a land of ghosts. He felt lost in his mind and wondered if all the boys would be there when he got home. But when he trotted through the chaparral toward the Hat Creek barn, he saw that it was old Bolivar himself, beating the same bell with the same piece of crowbar. The old man's hair was white and his serape filthier than ever. When Bolivar looked up and saw the captain riding out of the sunset, he dropped the piece of crowbar, narrowly missing his foot. His return to Mexico had been a trial and a disappointment. His girls were married and gone, his wife unrelenting in her anger at his years of neglect. Her tongue was like a saw, and the look in her eyes made him feel bad. So he had left her one day forever, and walked to Lonesome Dove, living in the house the gringos had abandoned. He sharpened knives to earn a living, which for himself was merely coffee and frijoles. He slept on the cook stove. Rats had chewed up the old beds. He grew lonely and could not remember who he had been. Still, every evening, he took the broken crowbar and beat the bell. The sound rang through the town and across the Rio Grande. When Call dismounted and dropped his reins, old Bolivar walked over, trembling, a look of disbelief on his face. "Oh, Capitan. Capitan," he said, and began to blubber. Tears of relief rolled down his rough cheeks. He clutched at Call's arms as if he were worn out and might fall. "That's all right, Bo," Call said. He led the shaking man to the house, which was all shambles and filth, spider webs and rat shit everywhere. Bo shuffled around and heated coffee, and Call stood on the front porch and drank a cup. Looking down the street, he was surprised to see that the town didn't look the same. Something wasn't there that had been. At first, he couldn't place what, and he thought it might be the dust or his erratic vision, but then he remembered the dry bean. It was the saloon that seemed to be gone. Call took the dun down to the roofless barn and unsaddled him. The stone watering trough was full of water, clear water, but there was not much to feed the horse. Call turned him out to graze and watched while he took a long roll. Then, curious to know if the saloon was really gone, he walked across the dry bed of Hat Creek and into the main street. He had no sooner turned into the street than he saw a one-legged man coming toward him through the dust. "Why, Gus," he thought, not knowing for a second if he were with the living or the dead. He remembered sitting in the grave on the Guadalupe, and for a moment could not remember climbing out. But the one-legged man only turned out to be Dillard Brawley, the barber who had ruined his voice screeching the time that he and Gus had to take off his leg. For his part, Dillard Brawley was so surprised to see Captain Call standing in the street that he almost dropped the few perch he had managed to catch in the river. In the growing dark, he had to step close to see if it was the captain. There was only a little light left.
"Why, Captain," Dillard said in his hoarse whisper, "did you and the boys finally get back?"
"Not the boys,"
Carl said.
Just me. What happened to the saloon?
He could see that he had been right. The general store was still there, but the dry bean was gone.
Burnt, Dillard whispered. Burnt near a year ago.
What started the fire? Carl asked.
Want started it. Burn up in it, too. Locked himself in that whore's room and wouldn't come out.
Well, I swear, Carl said.
The Pioneer burn up with him, Dillard said. Made the church folks mad. They thought if he was going to roast himself, he ought to have at least rolled the Pioneer out the door. They've had to sing hymns to a fiddle ever since.
Carl walked over and stood where the saloon had been. There was nothing left but pale ashes and a few charred boards.
When she left, Wants couldn't stand it. He sat in her room a month, and then he burned it.
Who? Carl asked, looking at the ashes.
The woman, Dillard whispered. The woman. They say he missed that whore.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this unabridged audio edition of Lonesome Dove. Phoenix Books publishes audiobooks in all genres and is proud to be the home of the complete library of Dove Audio, the renowned pioneer of audiobook recordings. You can find many of our audiobooks available for immediate listening when purchased and downloaded in digital format at your favorite online audiobook retailer. You can also visit our website at phoenixbooksinc.com to view titles published on CD, in print, and as digital ebooks. We continue to produce audio of both new and classic works, so please check back often. It has been said that works made available in digital format, such as this audio performance, are a kind of property which is at once the most precious, yet the most easily stolen, and the worst protected. We thank you for assisting us in protecting our precious works by your purchase of an authorized copy of this audio. We vehemently protect our rights under copyright, and will prosecute violators to the full extent of the law. So please, refrain from duplicating, transferring, storing on a retrieval system, or selling this audio by any means, in any form, without the express prior written permission of Phoenix Books. Such permission requests and other queries may be directed to us at info@phoenixbooksinc.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.